are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 15th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Amanda Taub of Vox.com. On the rise of American authoritarians. Also on the program, Putin, speaking of authoritarians, says Russia will at least partially withdraw from Syria. Chris Christie all but quits being governor of New Jersey. And we could be facing another budget crisis as the Freedom Caucus has told Paul Ryan to suck an egg. Meanwhile, the Obama administration wants three-year-olds to represent themselves in deportation court. Yes, three-year-olds. Much more extreme than their position that five-year-olds should represent themselves. Not particularly. Meanwhile, Debbie Wasserman Schultz doing everything she can to rig her election and just announced the Obama administration splits the baby in half. No new offshore drilling off the southeast coast of the United States, but the Arctic? Have at it. That should work out well. And a story about diapers, from which it's both appalling in some respects, but then also actually made me feel good about ourselves. I'll explain. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Let me explain the diaper thing. I'm going to go into it more in the fun half of the program. But the long and short of it is the cost of diapers for people who are living in poverty or near poverty is extreme. It is something like 14% of their annual budget. And I'll talk about the details later. The appalling part is just sort of how there's been attempts, of course, Democratic attempts to provide some help for people to pay for diapers for their kids. I mean, anybody who's a parent knows this. It's extremely expensive, but then you have access to different services that make it cheaper. Well, that's not an option for a lot of people living in poverty. You know, you don't have a car, going to the Sam's Club or whatever it is. Not an option. Jet.com. A show that, I mean, I don't know if I would call them one of our sponsors, but we have a deal with them where we get a kickback on anybody who buys through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. And one of the things I was excited about was that Jet just seems like a very good company to me. And they are providing like warehousing and shipping stuff for free shipping for diapers in bulk to community organizations. But somebody sent that to me on Twitter. It made me feel good. Made me feel good about myself. Meanwhile, Saul peed on me today, and it took a long time to get him out of the house, so it was a little bit late. I don't know why I mentioned that, other than somehow now I associate Harry's.com with my child. Maybe it's because it's their three-year anniversary of the company, and Saul just turned three. Maybe it's because Saul, like, literally the one way I can get him to calm down is to let him hold my, not my full-on razor, but just the razor handle. And now, apparently, Harry's has come out with a new Truman handle made of rubberized. It's completely rubberized. I, myself, I like the one that is sort of like that chrome quality, but to each their own. Look, I've got the best shave I've had in a long time from Harry's. Harry's blades are super sharp. They provide a close, comfortable shave. It is the only shaving company where you can sort of sign up and have them send it to you that gives you both amazing quality and low prices. German engineered, five-blade cartridges, close, comfortable shave, no cuts or burn. See this? I let my hair grow long because I'm not doing haze and I'm solo. Nikki's out of town, so I don't really think about shaving. I just think about just getting through the day. And but with those five blades, I don't have to worry about a little bit of growth. It doesn't bother me anymore. They ship them right to your door. They sell their blades at half the price of the leading brand. Over 1 million guys have already made the switch. Thousands more switch every day. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? You can get them for half the price at Harry's.com. The starter set is an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor, moisturizing cream, and three razor blades. Harry's doesn't like to discount, but they know that my son likes to play with razors. And as such, they will give you $5 off your first order with promo code MajorityReport. They accept no liability if I don't handle that thing with Saul appropriately. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to harrys.com right now. That's HARRYS.com. Enter the code MajorityReport at checkout. All right, so I got an email from a listener, and we've heard this from a couple of people, and this was apparently a big topic of discussion here about Trump and about the way the media has been portraying him all this time. And to a certain extent, I mean, we're part of the media on some level, and I don't know if that was so much the issue about the way that we handle it, although there's some of that. Certainly from this listener's perspective, it's about the way that we treat Trump. We will talk about that after the after this interview today. We're going to take a quick break. And I will remind you, actually, and this is interesting. In this piece by Amanda Taub, and I may cite this again with her, she cites research done by Jonathan Weiler, I think is the way his last name is pronounced. Jonathan Weiler, who has written about authoritarianism, was the first person that we ever had on this program as a guest when we launched this podcast, this version of the Majority Report. Like back in literally below zero in terms of our count. It was in November of 20. We had barely had the office set up, but this notion of authoritarianism, I mean, this is has been part and parcel of the Republican Party, as far as I could tell, at least since the early aughts. I mean, part and parcel. I'm sure there was a lot of it there before, but we'll talk to Amanda Taub about that and more. Quick break. Be right back.
Oh,
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome staff writer for Vox.com, Amanda Taub, on her most recent piece. I believe it was definitely a huge piece. The Rise of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to the program, Amanda.
Thanks, Sam. It's so great to be here.
So, all right, let's. This is obviously incredibly timely, and no coincidence, I guess, about that. But let's start with just what we have learned, and talk a little bit about the development of these theories. And I should say right off that you know, we spoke to Jonathan Weiler, who you cite at least having written a book. We spoke to him about 4 or 5 years ago on that book that he had put out at the time, because this was definitely a sense that this was out there. But tell us what we know, or what I guess authoritarianism is in general.
Sure. So when political scientists talk about authoritarianism, what they're really talking about is a kind of psychological disposition that makes people crave order and really be very attached to hierarchies and social stability. And when there is a lot of social change, or these people feel otherwise threatened, they're much more likely to want to support leaders who we might think of as kind of the authoritarian in the colloquial sense. So the kind of strongman figure who says, oh, you know, your problems are all due to XYZ group, and we're going to do whatever it takes. We're going to use force. We're going to use extreme policies, whatever it takes to rid ourselves of the problem. And so what political scientists like Jonathan Weiler, who you just mentioned, his co-author Mark Hetherington, and some other people who study this have found is that, first of all, you can test for this disposition. You can ask people 4 questions about their parenting preferences, which actually are very revealing about how they value things like hierarchies, order, authority, stability, etc.
All right, wait, let's. I just want to back up just a little bit. I mean, because this has been all right. So just to be clear for folks to understand, when we're talking about authoritarianism, we're actually talking about the followers, right? I mean, we're talking about it's. I mean, I guess it's just sort of, colloquially speaking, we talk about the leaders. But in this context, we're talking about a personality trait. I mean, what, and for a long time, I mean, this research, which sort of, I guess, tests for this disposition, is relatively new. Explain why it was so hard. Because there's this concept has been out there, right? I mean, since basically World War II, I guess, was the big example of people are asking the question, like, you know, I mean, this is Hannah Arendt stuff, right? I mean, how did people do this?
Right. So you're completely correct. This is a field of study that began after World War II with political scientists, sociologists, other researchers, essentially trying to explain the Nazis and how anti-Semitism and fascism and those types of political forces became so powerful and so damaging in Europe during World War II. But the field really struggled for a long time to be rigorous and quantitative, because these are very sensitive questions. You know, you can't ask somebody, do you support the Nazis? You can't ask somebody, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how racist do you think you are? How much do you fear groups who aren't like you? And expect them to give honest or reliable answers, because those are just such sensitive topics. And also, they're very subjective.
Right.
But then what a researcher named Stanley Feldman, as well as his colleague, a woman named Karen Stenner, figured out is you could ask people these 4 parenting questions, and they would reveal their kind of deeper preferences and priorities. And those answers correlate very strongly with what Feldman calls the action side of authoritarianism. So that is support for authoritarian leaders and authoritarian policies. And I would just say that, you know, when you think about the kind of classical authoritarian leader, it is somebody who is, you know, they're very forceful. They have a political style that is very punitive. It's very focused on kind of finding somebody to blame and promising to punish them harshly for it. And what researchers like Feldman, Weiler, and Mark Hetherington told me when I spoke to them is that Donald Trump really fits the kind of classic image of the authoritarian political style. So the two sides of this are, on the one hand, the political disposition and psychological disposition among the supporters, why people would want to support a leader like that. But then the other side of it is this action side, political policies and politicians who suit this authoritarian demeanor and kind of suit the
I want to put a pin in that because I want to ask, I want to talk about whether or not, you know, in the absence of Trump, what, you know, who would have stepped into that role, or are there other people competing for that role in the Republican Party, or, you know, let's be fair, in the Democratic Party? I know that's not the case, but I'm going to pretend I want to get there because I know that we have, we at least have authoritarians who are in both parties. But let's, I want to go through these questions about parenting, because I think not only, obviously, are they sort of fascinating just to, you know, to find out how you sort of measure this for somebody. And, you know, I mean, this is one of those things where you could sort of see this in, like, you know, in lifestyle magazines, too, for, you know, just do you just check out whether or not you should be asking this of your potential life partner on some level. But It also, I think, sort of just gives a sense of what authoritarians are seeking. One is, please tell me what you think is more important for a child to have, independence or respect for elders. Presumably, I'm just guessing here, but respect for elders is what an authoritarian would choose, right? I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, don't tell me that beforehand because I want to see what my tendencies are.
Okay.
Please tell me which one you think is more important for a child to have, obedience or self-reliance. Now, my heart says self-reliance. I deal with the child all the time. I mean, frankly, you know, my answer to all these questions would be like, do I have to have a child? But I have two, and so that's just the way it is. So I'm going to go self-reliance on that. But obedience would be what an authoritarian wants, right?
That's right.
And then please tell me what you think is more important for a child to have, to be considerate or well-behaved. I would say be considerate because just don't be a jerk. And well-behaved implies, like, you know, you don't talk unless you're talked to. I presume well-behaved is the authoritarian. And lastly, please tell me which one you think is more important for a child to have, curiosity or good manners. And I would say, of course, curiosity. It, I mean, it's so strange because I have a feeling of the vast majority of people listening to that go like, those are slam dunk questions. like, you know, it's like immediately you see right through this. Of course, nobody wants their kid to be a little robot. But the interesting thing is that it goes both ways, right? Like, as a parent, if I'm authoritarian, I want my kids to just be part of a hierarchy so that I'm middle management, right? And presumably there's higher management, right? That could, I guess, theoretically be, if I'm a woman, my husband, and then if I'm a husband, it would be maybe my boss, and maybe then God or the, you know, or Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, I think the specifics of what hierarchies people are envisioning when they answer these questions are really kind of beyond the scope of this test. What's really going on here is all of these questions are asking people to weigh two values against each other. And roughly speaking, in each case, the value is something along the lines of how important is it for somebody to kind of follow their own beliefs and values versus how important is it for them to follow the rules that society lays out. So with parenting, the rules are the ones that the parents make. So, you know, you're asking questions about obedience. The same with good manners. You know, good manners are about following kind of society's rules for good behavior versus being, you know, curious and figuring out what you want to know, regardless of whether it's really socially acceptable. And the same with, you know, the difference between being considerate and being well-behaved. I think there are very few parents out there who would say, you know, I don't want my child to be considerate, or I don't want my child to be well-behaved. Most people value both of those things, but which one you value more says a lot about how important you think rules are.
And what to what extent does this stuff correlate with Orthodox religion, with fundamentalism?
So I have to say that's actually not something that we tested for. So in the article that you mentioned, we asked people a lot of questions about other kind of values and concerns that they have and other policy preferences. We didn't ask them about those type of religious questions because actually that's another area where one person's idea of what fundamentalism means is very different from somebody else's. And so it really would have been kind of beyond the scope of what we were doing in terms of social science.
You'd have to develop another test for just whether or not they are in fact sort of a fundamentalist, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I don't know if that would be the same across all religions. So I think that is the kind of question that actually gets very difficult to test for accurately. So I can't really say.
All right. And so is there something unique about, before we go into sort of like, how authoritarianism actually works? Well, maybe we should go into that first and then we'll go into, but there were three, once you determine whether or not someone has that sort of tendency, I guess, there were three basic insights that you talk about, or I guess that the research talks about authoritarianism that deals with polarization.
Hello?
Can you hear me? Amanda?
Hello?
Amanda, are you there? I feel like we might have lost Amanda. Hello? That's very strange. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm going to try and ring her again. So, Amanda, there are three insights here about authoritarians. The first is deals with polarization. The second deals with the concept of activation, and then the third has to deal with basically how you can be, an ad hoc authoritarian. Let's start with this notion of polarization. Authoritarians used to be fairly well dispersed, I guess, through our political spectrum, and that's not the case so much anymore, is it?
That's right. So this is actually something that Hetherington and Weiler found when they were researching political polarization, which is that over the past few decades, authoritarians have been filtering more and more into the Republican Party. And they suggest that the reason for this is that the Republican Party has positioned itself as kind of the champion of traditional values. And because authoritarians feel kind of threatened and anxious about social change, that's a very kind of appealing position for them to perceive. And so, you know, since basically the civil rights movement, women's rights, things like same-sex marriage, over and over, the Republican Party has kind of positioned themselves against those changes, and that has appealed to authoritarians. And so what that means is that there's just this big constituency now within the Republican Party of authoritarian voters that is becoming a kind of bigger and bigger base of potential votes that Republican politicians can appeal to.
And that ties into this second theory of activation. So we already have this sort of notion out there that folks are under attack in some way from social change. I mean, I think I describe conservative as sort of like a 24/7, 365 living in Masada, where they are convinced that the hordes are out there to get them, and it's life or death behind the walls of their barricade. And then you talk about this theory of activation, which I imagine you have this sort of like notion of social change that provides this sort of low-grade anxiety that they're under siege, and then 9/11 happens.
So, yeah, it's not just 9/11, but it's kind of any kind of frightening change. So this is research from a political scientist named Karen Stenner, and what she found in her work was that authoritarianism as a kind of, you know, personal disposition can be latent. It can sort of, somebody could have those values, but it might not actually affect their political preferences if it's not a time of kind of stress and social change. So people with that disposition can be what she called activated by high stress, which could be social change, it could be economic stress, it could be something like terrorism. You just mentioned 9/11. That was obviously very frightening for people of all kinds in this country. And when that happens, they respond by kind of having more actively authoritarian political preferences. So that could mean supporting a kind of strongman leadership style. It could mean supporting authoritarian policies, such as those that sacrifice civil liberties or other kinds of personal freedoms in the hope that it will prevent terrorist attacks. And so that's why this can become a more potent political force at certain times.
So we have this idea of, so I guess maybe the social anxiety is also of the same kind, I guess, as, you know, sort of this notion of like existential anxiety, right? So it could be just, you know, gays are getting married and the Muslims, you know, or ISIS is coming for us. Those have the same type of impact. Is there also sort of like a set of sort of personal things? I mean, can if somebody gets divorced, I guess lose a job, would these things would also play into sort of activating this?
So I'm actually not sure about that. That's largely because in our own polling, we were trying to focus on more kind of broad national issues to find out what might be affecting the country as a whole. But I will say that, you know, those things often tend to be related. So we know that economic stress and divorce rates can be correlated, for instance. So I think that you're right that there's not necessarily a huge separation between the personal and the political. And this is just another example of that.
All right. And here, the third insight is sort of almost the most, is the one I think that people get really worried about when they talk about worst case scenarios, with Donald Trump being, for instance, in the general election, right? And this is sort of the one where if people feel sufficiently scared, non-authoritarians can act like authoritarians. So this is like the scenario where there's a major terrorist attack in the United States in mid-October, right? I mean, this is the one where you start getting non-authoritarians acting like authoritarians.
That's right. And we've seen this in history. So political scientists studied the U.S. electorate after the September 11th attacks, and they found very widespread support for a while for policies that are more typically associated with authoritarians. So things like, you know, support for what the government called enhanced interrogation, the rest of us would call torture, support for, profiling of people in airports based on their ethnicity, things like that. People were very afraid, and support for those kind of policies goes up at times when people are very afraid. And I agree that, you know, it's very frightening. But it's also a reminder that we shouldn't be demonizing authoritarian voters as somehow extremely different from the rest of us. What they really are is more scared, but any of us could be scared.
Well, they're more scared, or they have they're more scared, but they have a lower threshold for what scares them.
Yeah, and it's also just a different threshold. So it is, you know, I, as it happens, score pretty low on this authoritarianism scale. I get pretty excited about social change and diversity, and so those things just don't frighten me. But for authoritarians, they really value kind of the status quo, they value conformity, they value order, so they see things like outsiders coming into their communities as a threat to what they care about, because one of the things they care about is things staying the same.
Right.
Seems threatening to them in a way that it wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, I want to be fair about this in terms of, like, you know, we can have qualitatively differences, but I mean, quantitatively speaking, is there any research? Do non-authoritarians simply are afraid of less things? Is there a scenario where, I mean, I guess except for, let's say, just, you know, the idea of Donald Trump winning, I guess, would not be scary to authoritarians. It may be to some non-authoritarians. Right. But outside of something that narrow, is it a fair statement to say that authoritarians are afraid of more things?
I really think that it's a better way to think about it is that they are afraid of different things. But I think, you know, that because there's this kind of social aspect that they are afraid of that non-authoritarians are not. And I think that's a little bit more of a precise way to think about it. But it is true. Like, there's this source of fear and anxiety for them that there isn't for other people. So when I talked to Mark Hetherington, who is one of the researchers who has studied this issue in the most depth, he said that a lot of it really comes down to having a lower threshold of trust generally for other people. So, you know, if you're an authoritarian, you are maybe more threatening to you to have kind of more people in less predictable scenarios because you don't trust people as much. You find them more frightening, and the more different they are, the more kind of alien their ways seem to you, the more frightening that is.
And okay. So, this stuff is, you know, I mean, so much of the way that we talk about authoritarians, I mean, you could listen to Rush Limbaugh, as I have had for far, far too long and far too much. But this is basically what he is has been telling people for years, is just pointing out different threats to them and sort of, I guess, you know, making sure that that trust boundary is not crossed. In other words, making sure that there is a divide between any inclination people who listen to him have to perhaps give the benefit of doubt to any, or to even, recognize and not stifle that self-doubt that might come in, like, hey, there could be something to, you know, maybe I shouldn't feel threatened by this. I mean, it's really fascinating in that way. And so you have these issues of issues about authoritarians, and you guys set up a your own poll. Tell us about that and what you were looking to do.
So we did a fairly large poll with a media and polling company called Morning Consult of American voters. And what we were trying to do is basically just test this theory. We wanted to find out if it was true that authoritarianism correlated strongly with support for Trump. We also wanted to see if it would prove true in our own polling that authoritarians skewed Republican, that they were more worried than non-authoritarians about various types of social change. And we also wanted to see what their policy preferences looked like. And what we found was basically all of that was true. Scoring high on authoritarianism, so people who answered either three or four of the parenting questions with the authoritarian answer, was very strongly predictive of voting for Trump. I think in our polling, the only thing that came close to that was having a low level of education. But when I shared our results with some of these researchers and they ran various tests on it, and they agreed that this was a pretty strong correlation. And the other thing that we found was it was true that authoritarians were more concerned about various types of threats, but they fell into a couple of particular categories. So authoritarians were more concerned than non-authoritarians about threats that kind of arose out of foreign-seeming people. So the governments of Iran and Russia, for instance, and terrorist organizations like ISIS, people who scored highly on authoritarianism were much, much more likely to say that those things threatened them personally. They were comparatively less concerned about things like car accidents, which actually do probably pose a greater danger to most people living in the United States, just statistically, but they didn't feel as worried about those. And then the same with social change. So we asked people about a long list of things like, same-sex couples being allowed to get married, Muslims building mosques in American cities, et cetera. And we asked them to rate whether they were good or bad for the country. And people who scored highly on authoritarianism were much more likely to rate those kind of social issues as being bad for the country. And vice versa, people who scored low were much likely, more likely to rate them high as good for the country.
Now, Amanda, let me just stop you here for a minute. And because you are, as a reporter, I think that you are more measured than I am, and you are also, I think, just probably have a more generous heart than I do. But when I hear somebody say, I am more personally afraid of ISIS, presuming they're in the country, right, and they're not actually on the front lines, I'm more afraid of ISIS right. than I am of dying into a car accident. My reaction to that, and you need to sort of just, how would you dissuade me from this? That is like, ungenerously is delusion, and generously is just like a phobia. Like I'm afraid of being eaten by a spider. In terms of like my capacity to measure what is real. Right? Because there is a real threat that, if my kid goes outside that he could get, he could get into a car accident. But there is really no statistical, there's a slight possibility, I guess, but that he could get blown up by ISIS. How do you dissuade me from that perspective? Or is it just like, that's just a function of maybe there's a test for people like me who are just a little more cynical?
I don't think it's necessarily cynicism. I would say that I personally am actually very afraid of car accidents. I don't have a car. I don't drive. It's not familiar to me. So car accidents actually seem pretty scary. And
statistically speaking, they should be more.
I actually, don't spend much time in a car. So I'm probably not actually at a huge amount of risk from car accidents. But I would say that it really is an indication of kind of not just the kind of quantum of the risk, but what risks are particularly frightening to people. So car accidents are certainly, as you said, much more likely to hurt somebody who is an American living in the United States. They're pretty dangerous and they happen a lot. But people, I think, have a greater sense of control, perhaps even a greater sense of control than they should over whether they're going to get in a car accident because, mm-hmm. You're in your car, you can steer away from it. And I think that is reassuring to some people. And also we asked about car accidents. We didn't ask about reckless drivers.
Right.
So we weren't asking about the people. And one of the things that research in authoritarianism suggests is that they are more afraid of people than things. So they're less concerned about things like car accidents. When I spoke to Professor Weiler, he also said they tend to be less concerned about climate change. That wasn't something that we tested for. But again, it's something that is not a specific threat from an unfamiliar or frightening person. It's kind of a more general physical phenomenon. And so that is just a very different type of psychological disposition, I think, in terms of what seems scary.
All right. So let me ask you, there's a couple more questions here. In getting back to that specific breakdowns of by party, because, I think this is like, the $64,000 question is, what percentage of people, assuming no horrific event that would create an authoritarian reaction in non-authoritarians. What you say 75% of Democrats are non-authoritarian. Does that mean that there's 25% of Democrats out there that could respond to an authoritarian message?
So I would actually say that I am less confident in the results for Democrats than I am for Republicans, because Republicans skew white and the four-question authoritarianism measure is actually more precise when it's used on white respondents. And if you think about that, you can sort of imagine why a question about, you know, is it, how important is it for your child to be kind of obedient and responsive right. to authority? That could have kind of different connotations if you're a minority in this country than if you're a white person. So I think there are some understandable reasons to be a little bit skeptical of that. But the kind of basic question that you're asking is, are there a lot of authoritarians in the Democratic Party? The answer is yes, but it's not a majority by any means. And there are many more of them in the Republican Party. So in our sample, I think more than 60% of the Republican voters who responded to our survey, I think more than 60% of the sample scored as somewhat high or very high authoritarian. And I think that that's a function of the kind of polarization over time that these researchers have been studying.
To what extent do, and because I don't think this was addressed, and I wonder if it came up in your reporting, but what extent is this taught? In other words, like, I mean, and that's what's sort of fascinating about the parenting questions, right? Because, you know, particularly African Americans have a and minorities, you know, broadly speaking, have a different relationship with, you know, police, let's say, in the country. So the idea of, like, you know, I'm not going to have that talk with my son that right. Apparently a lot of African-American fathers have to have and mothers have to have with their sons and daughters, which is, you know, if you see a cop, you know, make sure that you are, you know, curiosity goes out the window. You're well behaved and whatnot. But I wonder if it's also taught on the other side. I mean, in other words, like, is this reinforced? I mean, left to their own devices, would these authoritarians, if they had been starved of media and starved of other institutions, or is this something that is taught?
I think that there it does seem to be a kind of taught component of it. And I guess you could also say a cultural component. For instance, authoritarianism correlates pretty highly with being less educated, which doesn't necessarily mean that one causes the other, but it kind of at least suggests that as you become more educated, you maybe become less concerned about change in the world and kind of more able to engage with newer, different ideas and people without feeling quite as threatened by them. And which you can sort of imagine, right? Like a classroom can be a pretty safe environment to encounter those kinds of things. And once you've done it there, it might be easier to do it in the outside world. And so I think to some extent it is absolutely taught. It can be cultural. But like all of these things, there could also just be a basic personality component.
Right. So, and what also I found fascinating, and this leads me to sort of the broadly speaking, the final questions, as it were. What do we do about this? I mean, what I found really interesting was that when the other Republican candidates, or well, I guess I also want to ask that question, like, you know, in the absence of Trump, who would they have gone to? But what was interesting is that, you know, you talked about when the other candidates tried to echo Trump as a way of dissuading his followers, they would inevitably enhance the fear that Trump's followers would are feeling, and Trump is just a better solution to those fears from their perspective, right? Because of the divide between, you know, sort of having the fears and sort of the action component of what they want to respond to that. I mean, just talk about that dynamic. And I'm also curious, you know, is Ted Cruz the guy who they would have gone to if it hadn't been for Trump? Or do these people just stay home and say, oh, I'm just going to sit this one out because there's nobody up there talking about really addressing this in a draconian way?
So I think to kind of take, there were a bunch of questions in there, so I'll try to hit them all. I think the first thing that you pointed out is right, which is that even though these other candidates are trying to kind of get in on the authoritarian style, particularly when they talk about foreign policy, and when they talk about things like immigration by Muslims to the U.S. or Syrian refugees, they're not really able to out-authoritarian Donald Trump. So to the extent that they're kind of reinforcing the voters' views that this is the kind of leadership that's necessary, they're not doing a very good job of convincing them that they're the people to provide it. So I think that's part of what's going on here. You also asked what we would be seeing if Trump was not a candidate. And I think that we would be seeing probably fairly similar campaigns by people like Cruz and Rubio, because there is this authoritarian kind of group of voters within the Republican primary electorate, and they are looking for a candidate who will offer them these kinds of policies. But I think that Trump has certainly dragged things further to the extreme with his just real extreme rhetoric on a lot of these issues.
And so what happens? Okay, so let's the scenario Trump loses. I mean, I do think he is sort of at least to some degree uniquely situated to capitalize on this, because he also, it's not just his authoritarianism, right? I mean, it's, we also, at least in the Republican Party, the idea of a CEO president and the idea of wealth being a sign of moral righteousness or just simply righteousness in some way has also been ingrained, at least in the Republican voter's mind, it seems to me, for, you know, at the very least 20 years.
I would say that's maybe part of it, but, you know, I certainly found, at least in our polling, that the kind of classic Republican economic policies, things like free trade or, you know, cutting taxes on high-earning individuals, were not nearly as popular with authoritarians.
I'm not suggesting
some of the kind of authoritarian policies like a forceful overseas foreign policy.
But I'm not talking about policies. I'm just talking about character. You know, I mean, we have been told, right? I mean, George W. Bush was the CEO president, and then. And then we had, I mean, McCain, I guess, was a slight step away from that. But we had Mitt Romney. I mean, this is not, you know, I think the idea of a billionaire being up on stage with these other people who are trying to, you know, the sunny side of Republicanism, right, is that we can all get wealthy. Well, you know, Paul Ryan's brown bag makes you feel bad if you get a brown, you know, if you get a free lunch from school. Well, I mean, here's Donald Trump. He doesn't just bring a non-free lunch to school. I mean, he has his catered. And and so he becomes, he's all those things that that the Republicans, which I think is an overlay on that notion of authoritarianism. But so, assuming to a certain extent,
I think, you know, it also just helps to be really, really rich if you're running for president. It means that you are much more able to be independent of the kind of Republican establishment. You don't need them to help you raise money.
That's right.
So, you know, but he being does, a billionaire has its benefits.
Yes. And he does. He can't. But he also, I mean, I really do think like there's a lot to be said for that 747 when it pulls in. It says Trump on it. And he just looks like, you know, his isn't quite the Air Force One, but it's better than everybody else's. I mean, that's for sure.
Right.
Well, so let me ask you this. I mean, what happens to these authoritarians? Where do they, does it end if Trump loses in either the primary or the general, or do they double down?
I don't think it does.
No,
I don't think it does. You know, I think that these people, they're still around. They still have their preferences. It's, you know, Trump, if nothing else, has shown that a candidate can do extremely well by appealing to these kind of voter preferences. And I think that the Republican Party has shown that it really doesn't have an answer to a candidate like Trump, who is willing to kind of jettison the main planks of the kind of classic conservative economic platform in exchange for some kind of basic economic nationalism and this kind of authoritarian bluster. The Republican Party hasn't been able to do anything about that. And I think that the next time a candidate wants to run and make a national name for themselves, they're not going to forget that this really helps Donald Trump do well in this campaign.
Yeah. I mean, and why just national? I mean, if I'm a congressman, right, who's watching Trump, this is a model, it seems to me. I mean, you know, and if I mix the economic policies of you know, what is sort of typical, I should be two for two, right? I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, can you imagine?
I think that's right. And I think, you know, particular districts may have more authoritarian voters because of their kind of demographics. They may be under more stress because of their economic situation, and that would make it a kind of particularly fruitful option for that kind of politician.
Lastly, let me ask you this. Do you think that Trump would be as successful if he did have more doctrinaire conservative economic policies? In other words, if he wasn't talking, I mean, I guess he has to talk about trade as being problematic, right? Because it's the outside, the sneaky Chinese, I think he said at one point or whatever, you know, sort of taking advantage of us, and the sort of the weak need who won't stop the Chinese from doing that. But could he have fashioned a more a doctrinaire conservative or Republican policies and done this, or is it really come to loggerheads when it sort of increases the fear?
So I think that it's hard for me to say what he could have done, but it does seem pretty clear that those kind of breaks with establishment conservatism have really helped his candidacy. So one is, as you point out, it's a way to kind of talk about outsiders as villains and paint kind of foreign trade as the problem that's at the root of people's economic woes. Works very well for him. Another is it means that he doesn't have to kind of limit himself in the kinds of populist policies he can say that he would pursue. And, you know, especially among kind of poorer voters under more economic stress, it's not really popular to say you're going to do something like cut healthcare or limit Social Security, because a lot of those voters really need those programs. And then the last thing that I think it allows him to do is paint himself as that much more of an outsider, kind of standing up to the political establishment. And that is something that has made him look even more powerful and even more kind of brave to his supporters, that he's willing to do that. So I think that's been a real benefit to his candidacy.
It's interesting, too, the way that trust plays in this, because I think one of the things that it's that as much as it makes him an outsider, I think it creates trust in the Republican voter when they see him say something that is heresy. And regardless of whether it's policy or not, you know, just even George Bush was president on 9/11. When he says something that is heretical, that theoretically should hurt him in the campaign, I think that signals to his potential, supporters, he's really talking straight with us. Even if I disagree with him, I can trust him. And it's interesting, you know, sort of when you balance that against sort of the authoritarian, proclivity to distrust people.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that it makes him seem like a leader who's kind of strong enough to steamroll any institution or norm that would stand in his way. And I think that really appeals to people.
Well, this has all been very encouraging, Amanda. But
everything is great. It's all going to go really well.
There we go. But it's also very fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today. Amanda Taub from Vox.com, Rise of the American Authoritarianism. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right. We're going to link to that on the site at majority.fm. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. Tonight is, pretty Super Tuesday. What do we call this? Second Super Tuesday?
Significant Tuesday.
Ides of March? Is it Ides of March? I thought it was March 5th was the Ides, but I guess it's the 15th.
The Ides of March.
My Latin is just so rusty.
That wasn't a great movie.
What's the Ides of March?
Yeah.
You know that was not just a movie, right? It's also
a play.
It was a play. Right, exactly. And I think it was even a book before. All right. So just a reminder, tonight we have Florida, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, and Ohio. Donald Trump is up in all those except for Ohio in terms of the polling, but not by much. I mean, Florida, he seems to be up by a lot. And I have a feeling he's going to really take Florida, just because he's Mar-a-Lago is so beautiful and it's such a great place. Illinois, he's only up by 5 or 6, I think the same in Missouri, and North Carolina, I think he's up by more, but that is because of, you know, the growing hordes of African-American people in North Carolina sort of activate the authoritarians there. In Ohio, Kasich is supposedly up. We'll see. I think Kasich could do well in Ohio. We're going to talk in the fun half about whether or not Kasich winning is good. There's different theories in terms of whether or not Trump makes it through the primaries. Also, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton doing extremely well in Florida. But this is all polling that, you know, we have at least have Michigan to give us pause as to the ability of people to poll this Democratic race. In Illinois, appears to be a virtual tie, as far as I can tell. Missouri, also a virtual tie. North Carolina, I think Clinton is doing much better there. And in Ohio, she's up by maybe about a half a dozen, maybe a little bit more. But again, Ohio is as much like Michigan as anywhere else. And we saw that 20-point swing on, no, more, 25-point swing on the polling in Michigan. So this is going to be a very important night for Bernie Sanders. If he wants to sort of remain mathematically viable, he's got to make sure that she has no blowouts. That's the big thing here because of the proportionality of the delegates. But, you know, again, there's a lot of value to go into that convention with 45% of the delegates. And so we shall see. In terms of Trump, my personal opinion is that dude's going to be the Republican nominee unless they do something hinky at the convention. And, you know, why not? Why not do something hinky at the convention if they can do it? But we're going to take a quick break. And we're also, I have an email from let me just read this listener email and then we'll go to the break because we're going to be talking about this. I'm a huge fan of what you guys do, which I think is demonstrated by the fact that I'm a member. Well, thank you. I live in Australia. Wow. Yeah. See what I'm talking about?
Global reach.
I live in Australia, and I don't know if this guy's an American expat or not. Either way, I don't think it matters. Australians tend to know as much about American politics as Americans do, but they also seem to know about politics all around the world. But that's because they just lollygag around all the time. They don't work, and they just surf, as far as I can tell. But I think your treatment of Trump as a joke is a problem. He goes on to say, I understand you guys called out Trump was going to be a problem very early on. You continue to do that. But at the same time, the amount of time you guys spend doing things like calling out the last Republican debate is boring because they weren't physically hitting each other with sticks, or doing an impression of him over and over again while laughing at his buffoonery seems to far outweigh the amount that you call him out for being an a-hole fascist. And I wonder that it has a normalizing effect on him with segments of your audience and contributes to the problem overall with the way Trump is viewed. End of the day, I'm going to continue to be a supporter because I think what you do is incredible. Personally, I think you should start treating Trump less like a joke and more as a world-destroying threat. I know you guys had a little mini debate here. Non-Sargon debate yesterday about this. We will talk more about it in the fun half again, folks, because apparently this is the big story. This is the big story, is the election right now. But we've got other stories as well in the fun half.
The election's big story.
What's that?
The election. Matt. The election's big story right now?
The election apparently is a very big story.
Okay. You heard it here first. That's right.
Breaking news. The election is a big story. I know, but it's annoying because, you know, I mean, if first of all, if I came from a different country, but like the election, when is that? Is that in, is it in, is it in May? Is it in June? July? August? September? October?
We really should do it where we call an election and you can't get like the whole election complex ramped up to, you know, for 8 years, like the way UK does it.
Yeah, we as a media outlet may just do what the Huffington Post does and says we're just not going to, like they did with Trump in the beginning.
That worked well.
We're just going to put him in the entertainment section. And so we're just going to pretend like this is not happening.
Fascio-tainment.
That's all right. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920. I will turn on the IM machine. Folks, your membership makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you want to buy something through jet.com, do so at our link, majorityreportkickback.com. If you're still using Amazon, the least you can do is use our link, majorityreportkickback.com. We'll be right back.